are here to help. There is no reason to believe that these strategies, insurgency, false humility, security and simplicity, plus discounting, won't work again one day against the horsemen. Giant companies face their own challenges. They lose their best talent to more rewarding startups. Their physical plant grows old. Their empires grow so big they can no longer coordinate all their pieces. They get distracted by investigations by envious or nervous governments. The processes put in place to scale begin slowing the firm down, as managers begin believing that adhering to the guidelines is more important than making good decisions. Bezos insists that there will never be a day two. It may seem unlikely that Amazon will one day lose its way. It will. Business mimics biology, and, thus far, the mortality rate is 100%. The same is true of the four. They will die. The question is not if, but when, and by whose hand. Chapter 8. The T Algorithm. At some point, there will be a fifth horseman, a company that combines a market valuation of $1 trillion with sufficient market dominance to define its corner of the world. Or, more likely, one of the four will be replaced. Can we identify companies more likely to join this elite group? While history may not repeat itself, it does rhyme, as Mark Twain purportedly said. Among the four, these eight factors are prevalent: product differentiation, visionary capital, global reach, likability, vertical integration, AI, accelerant, and geography. These factors provide an algorithm, rules for what it takes to become a trillion-dollar company. In our work at L2, we use the term T-algorithm to help firms better allocate capital. Here are the eight factors. 1. Product differentiation. The key competence around building shareholder value in retail used to be location. People didn't have the opportunity to go much farther than the corner store. Then it was distribution. The railroads gave consumers the opportunity to enjoy different products produced at scale, which lowered prices and gave them brands they could depend on. We then moved to an era of product, especially in the automobile and appliance industries, largely fostered by the innovation that was a peace dividend from World War II. We got better cars, washing machines, television sets, even better apparel. The leather bomber jacket was invented in World War II, as was silly putty, radar, microwaves, jet engines, the transistor, and the computer. That led to the financial age, in which a group of companies using cheap capital to roll up other companies into conglomerates built the ITTs of the world. This in turn was followed by the great brand age of the 80s and 90s, when the key to building shareholder value was to take an average product, shoe, beer, soap, and build aspirational, intangible associations around it. As discussed in the second chapter, we are again back to an era of product, as new technologies and platforms, be it Facebook or Amazon user reviews, let consumers conduct diligence across a broad array of products in a fraction of the time it used to take to shop. The ability to conduct diligence has never been easier, which reduces the need to default to brand or reputation. Now, the best product has a better chance of breaking through the clutter, whereas before, the best product without any marketing was like a tree falling in the forest. Moreover, the injection of digital brains into otherwise static, inanimate products has ushered in a new wave of innovation in which custom, personalizable apps can be quickly downloaded and upgraded without the need to replace the original box. A mattress is a mattress until you get an iPad and some basic technology. Then you can program in an ultimate sleep number, and so can your partner. Or you can order the best mattress online, avoiding those damp warehouses called mattress stores, and have it delivered in a box And, cooler yet, watch it unfurl when dumped out of the box. I have to take my car to the dealership to get a tune-up. My neighbor has his tune-up transmitted wirelessly into his Tesla's operating system. The engine receives an upgrade and instructions to remove the speed regulator, and the car's top speed increases from 140 to 150 remotely. Do you remember who made your landline phone before chips and wireless set them free? Nearly every product in the world, even products and services that appear to have been commoditized, have forged new dimensions and consumer value, enabled by cheap sensors, chipsets, the internet, networks, displays, search, social, and so on. Today, almost every link of the supply, manufacturing, and distribution chains has a new means of differentiation. All of a sudden, products driven by technology and defensible IP are the bomb. However, don't be trapped into thinking that product differentiation is about the widget you're selling. Differentiation can occur where consumers discover the product, how they buy it, the product itself, how it's delivered, and so on. A worthwhile exercise is to map out the value chain of your product or service from the origin of the materials through its manufacture, retail, usage, and disposal, and identify where technology can add value or remove pain from the process or experience. You'll find that this value can affect every step. And if you happen to spot a step where it hasn't, start a new company there. Amazon is adding technology and billions to the fulfillment segment of the consumer experience that will likely create the most valuable firm in the world. Before Amazon, ordering from Williams-Sonoma meant you would pay $34.95 to get the product in a week. Now it's free in 2 days or less. The most mundane part of the supply chain ended up being the most valuable in the history of business. Removal. When brainstorming for new ideas, entrepreneurs have a tendency to focus on what can be added, how to enhance the experience, instead of what can be taken away, thus making it less painful. But I'd argue that the majority of stakeholder value created over the last decade has been a function of removal. We as a species have mostly figured out what makes us happy. Time with loved ones, physical and mental stimulation, substances that heighten or deaden those feelings, Netflix, and sassy church signs. You may be tempted to think the competitive advantage in the internet age comes down to simply more for less. After all, that's an obvious edge enjoyed by Amazon. But what about Apple? It's almost always the premium-priced brand, and though its products are typically better than the competition, they usually aren't that much better for the prices Apple charges. I would argue Amazon could charge as much for its products as do its brick-and-mortar competitors, and would still dominate the marketplace. Why? Because it's still infinitely easier to hit a couple keys on your computer to buy a book or a piece of furniture than it is to drive down to the local mall, find a parking place, walk a half mile, be overwhelmed by tons of irrelevant merchandise, and then lug your shit back to your car for the drive home. Amazon has removed all that friction and brings your purchases to your door for less than the cost of gas for your own car. So, while it may seem that the value explosion brought by the technology revolution comes from the addition of new features and capabilities, its greater contribution comes from removing obstacles and time killers from our daily lives. Friction is everywhere. For example, there is a ton of friction in transportation. That's why Uber saw an opportunity via GPS, texting, and online payment, and removed the pain and anxiety of ordering a car, wondering, where the hell is the car? And fumbling around in the back of the car at the end of the journey, trying to dig out money and pay. How many of us recently have bombed out of a taxi without paying because we've become so used to frictionless Uber? Bottom line, paying is friction, and it is disappearing. Just as hotel checkout disappeared a decade ago, check-in will be a thing of the past in another 10 years. Some of the better hotels in Europe no longer require you to sign a bill after a meal. They know who you are and will charge you. Less is more. Each of the four has a superior product. It sounds old school, but Google really does have a superior search engine. The Apple iPhone is a better smartphone. The cleanliness of Facebook's feed, coupled with the network effect, the fact that everybody's on it, and a constant stream of new features, makes it a better product. Amazon redefined the shopping experience and expectations, from one-click ordering to getting your product within 2 days, or in hours, soon by drone or a truck UPS used to own. These are tangible innovations and points of product differentiation. All have been achieved through access to cheap capital set against deft technological innovation. Product is experiencing a renaissance, and is the first factor in the T algorithm. If you don't have a product that is truly differentiated, you have to resort to an increasingly dull yet expensive tool called advertising. 2. Visionary capital. The second competitive factor among the four is the ability to attract cheap capital by articulating a bold vision that is easy to understand. In Chapter 4, we discussed how visionary capital works for Amazon, but it is an advantage shared by three of the four horsemen. Google's vision, organizing the Earth's information. Simple, compelling, and a reason to buy the stock. Google has more money to invest in engineers than any media company in history. That lets it design more stuff, including autonomous vehicles. Facebook's vision, connecting the world. Consider how important and generally awesome that could be. Facebook is now worth more than Walmart and surpassed $400 billion in market value. Similar to Google, it too can place more bets and offer more generous parental leave, hire buses that transport you to work, turn the roof of your office building into a park, and even pay for you to freeze your eggs so you can delay that whole procreation thing and devote yourself to a real contribution to the species, connecting the world. Meanwhile, over Thanksgiving weekend 2016, Amazon captured the largest overall share of organic results for top gift items. Amazon is Google's biggest customer. Is search a skill set? No doubt Amazon is great at search, but its SEO skill would be Wayne Gretzky without a stick if it didn't throw tens of millions of cash at the issue. 1 in 6 people start their search for products using Google, making it the equivalent of the second biggest, first is Amazon, retail store window in the world. 55% start on Amazon. Take Macy's windows on Christmas and make it the size of Everest and K2. That's the size of the windows into the world that Google and Amazon search results represent in the fastest growing channel, online commerce. Anyone can purchase a place in that window and land at the top of a Google search. When someone types in Star Wars action figures, the retailer that has bid the most is going to top the paid listings. Amazon regularly buys that number one spot because it has the money to do so. And Amazon can afford this at a scale that no one else can match, as it has cheaper capital. The company is playing by a different set of rules, and with a whole different deck of cards. As J. Crew chairman Mickey Drexler points out, it's impossible to compete with a big company that doesn't want to make money. The strength of visionary capital begets competitive strength. Why? Because you can more patiently nurture assets, invest, and place more bets on more pockets of innovation, try crazy shit that just might change the game. Of course, you ultimately have to show shareholders tangible progress against your big vision. However, if you're able to make the jump to Lightspeed, and the market crowns you the innovator, the reward is an inflated valuation, and the self-fulfilling prophecy, we're number one, that comes from cheap capital. The ultimate gift in our digital age is a CEO who has the storytelling talent to capture the imagination of the markets while surrounding themselves with people who can show incremental progress against that vision each day. 3. Global reach. The third factor in the T algorithm is the ability to go global. To be a truly large, meaningful company, you need a product that leaps geographic boundaries and appeals to people on a global scale. It is not just the bigger marketplace, but the diversity, not least the prospect of counter-cyclical markets that can ride out a downturn elsewhere in the world, that investors want, again rewarding you with cheaper capital. If you have a product that appears to have global reach, you're accessing 7 billion consumers versus 1.4 billion in China, or 300 million in the United States or the EU. Again, it doesn't require world domination, but rather proof that your product or service is so digital-ish that the normal rules of cultural friction do not apply. Uber's revenue growth in countries outside the United States has a chaser effect on the firm's valuation, its multiple of revenues. And the first dollar earned outside the United States increased the value of the firm by billions. If you want to be a horseman, your product needs to get a passport. That is, go global before the kid starts kindergarten, 5 years old or less. Was this true of the four when they started? No, except for Google. But the very presence of the horseman has subsequently changed the rules. Apple today defines what it means to be global. The brand has largely been accepted in every sovereign nation. Google has also done a good job. It's strong in mature markets, but it's been kicked out of China. Facebook has 2/3 of its users outside the United States, though half of revenues are clocked in the United States. Its biggest market in terms of users is Asia, which presents robust growth opportunities. Amazon is growing faster in Europe than in the United States. It's still not as big in Asia, but it's a global company. 4. Likeability. The world of commerce is regulated. Government, independent watchdog groups, and the media play a large role in a company's growth. If you are perceived as a good actor, a good citizen, caring about the country, its citizens, your workers, the people in your supply chain that get you the product, you have created a barrier against bad publicity. In the words of Silicon Valley marketer Tom Hayes, who did just that for Applied Materials, when the news is negative, you want to be perceived as a good company to which a bad thing has happened. Image matters a lot. Perception is a company's reality. That makes the importance of being likable, even cute, the fourth factor in the T algorithm. Bill Gates and Steve Ballmer were neither likable nor cute. In fact, the room got brighter whenever they left it. So, when Microsoft achieved a certain level of influence, district attorneys and regulators woke up one morning all over Europe and decided the easiest way to the governor's mansion or parliament was to go after the Wizards of Redmond. The less likable a company, the sooner the regulatory intervention, antitrust, anti-privacy, as questions about its supply chain or any manner of rational concerns, are irrationally selected and applied. We are under the general illusion this process is more thoughtfully examined and based on some sort of equity or the law. Not true. The law decides the outcome, but the rush, or lack thereof, to drag companies into court is subjective. And that opinion is largely based on how nice or chastened the company is perceived to be. If you remember, the feds went after Intel Corporation at the same time they went after Microsoft, both for monopolistic behavior. Intel's CEO, Andrew Grove, was one of the scariest figures in American industry. Yet, when the feds came calling, Andy did one of the biggest mea culpas in business history. He all but flung himself on the mercy of the SEC, and was forgiven. Meanwhile, Bill Gates, a far less intimidating figure, decided to play tough with the feds, and 10 years later was viewed as having fallen from grace. Google is a whole lot cuter than Microsoft, and Sergey and Larry are more likable than Bill and Steve. Immigrants, nice-looking guys, a great story. Marissa Meyer, very compelling. Wisconsin engineer, blonde, future Vogue photo feature. It's no accident Google sent Ms. Meyer to Senate hearings to opine regarding the slaughter of newspapers at the hands of Google. Oops, I mean the future. When faced with tough questions like, how is the Fourth Estate going to survive if Google kills the newspaper classified business, Ms. Meyer responded, it's still early. Early? It was the 2-minute warning in the fourth quarter for newspapers. The gray-haired senators ate it up. Who wants to be the insurance salesman elected to Congress, the most prevalent career of the House of Representatives, who raises his hand and says, I'm the guy who does not get it. I don't like Apple. Apple is the largest tax avoider in the history of U.S. business. But Apple is hip and everyone wants to be friends with the cool kid. Same with Amazon, because e-commerce is hip and cool versus lame and old traditional retail. In March 2017, Amazon decided to pay sales tax in every state. Here's a company now worth more than Walmart that until 2014 was only paying state sales tax in 5 states. The benefit of the subsidy has eclipsed $1 billion. Did Amazon need a $1 billion government subsidy? By purposefully managing their business at break-even, Amazon has built a firm approaching $500 billion in value that has paid little corporate income tax. Facebook. Nobody wants to be seen as a company not on board with Facebook. Old CEOs want to put Mark Zuckerberg on stage with his hoodie. It doesn't matter that he is neither charming nor a good speaker. He's the equivalent of skinny jeans and makes every company that tries on Facebook look younger. Sheryl Sandberg also has been key. She is hugely likable and is seen as the archetype of the modern successful woman. Hey, everybody, lean in. Facebook has not come under the same scrutiny as Microsoft because it's more likable. Most recently, Facebook has attempted to skirt responsibility for fake news, claiming it's not a media company but a platform. Hiding behind freedom of speech and a word, Facebook may have committed involuntary manslaughter of the truth on an unprecedented scale. It's good to be prom queen. 5. Vertical integration. The fifth factor in the T algorithm is the ability to control the consumer experience at purchase through vertical integration. All of the four control their distribution. If they don't produce the product, they source it, they merchandise it, they retail it, and they support it. Levi's went from $7 billion to $4 billion from 1995 to 2005 because it didn't have control of its distribution. Seeing Levi's jeans piled up as you walk through JCPenney's is just not an aspirational experience. Cartier has caught, or possibly surpassed, Rolex's brand equity by making a big bet on its in-store experience. It turns out that where and how you buy a watch is as important as which tennis player wears that watch. Maybe more. The ROI of investing in the pre-purchase process, advertising, has declined. That's why successful brands are forward integrating, owning their own stores or shopper marketing. I believe P&G will begin acquiring grocery retail, as they must develop distribution that's growing and not depend on Amazon, who is their frenemy, minus the friend part. Google controls its point of purchase. In 2000, Google was growing so rapidly that Yahoo, the biggest search engine at the time, bought the rights to offer Google search on Yahoo's homepage. No longer. Facebook obviously is vertical, as is Amazon. Neither produces its own products, but other than sourcing and manufacturing, both control their entire user experience. the biggest innovation for Apple is considered to be the iPhone. But what put the company on track to be a trillion-dollar company was the genius move into retail, usurping control over its distribution and brand. A decision that, at the time, made little or no sense. A company has to be vertical to reach $500 billion in market valuation. That's easier said than done. And most brands leverage other companies' distribution, as distribution is expensive to build. If you're clothing designer Rebecca Minkoff, you're not going to build your own stores beyond a dozen flagship locations around the world. You don't have that capital. Instead, you sell your products at Macy's and Nordstrom's. Even if you're Nike, it's much more efficient to sell through Foot Locker than to build your own stores. The Four Horsemen are vertical. Few brands have been able to maintain an aspirational positioning without controlling a large portion of their distribution. Samsung is never going to be that cool. Not if it continues to depend on AT&T, Verizon, and Best Buy stores. Remember where you used to go to get your Apple computer fixed 15 years ago? There was a guy who looked like he'd never kissed a girl, but was a pro at fantasy adventure games. He stood at a counter in front of piles of gutted computer parts next to stacks of Macworld magazine. Apple sensed the shift and put people in blue shirts, titled them genius, and set them in places that brought Apple products to life, spaces whose materials reinforced how special and elegant Apple products are. Apple stores today are intentionally beautiful. They remind you that Apple, and those who purchase its products, get it. 6. AI. The sixth factor in the T algorithm is a company's access to and facility with data. A trillion-dollar company must have technology that can learn from human input and register data algorithmically. Himalayas of data that can be fed into algorithms to improve the offering. The technology then uses mathematical optimization that, in a millisecond, not only calibrates the product to customers' personal, immediate needs, but improves the product incrementally every time a user is on the platform for other concurrent or future customers. Marketing historically can be parsed into three major shifts regarding how potential customers were targeted. The first era was demographic targeting. Thus, white 45-year-old guys living in the city, in theory, will all act, smell, and sound alike, so they must all like the same products. That was the basis of most media buying. Then, for a hot minute, it went to social targeting, in which Facebook tried to convince advertisers if two people, regardless of their demographics, like the same brand on Facebook, they are similar and should be grouped or targeted by those advertisers. That turned out to be total bullshit. All it meant was they all shared the action of clicking like on a Facebook brand page, and that was about it. They didn't aspire to the same products and services. Social targeting was a failure. The new marketing is behavioral targeting. And it works. Nothing can predict your future purchases like your current activities. If I'm on the Tiffany website and I have searched for engagement rings and I have set up an appointment to purchase such a ring at a certain boutique, that likely means I am about to get married. If I'm spending a ton of time on the Audi site configuring an A4, then I am in the market for a $30,000 to $40,000 four-door luxury sedan. Thanks to artificial intelligence, we now can track behavior at a level and scale previously unimaginable. It's no accident when I start getting served Audi ads all over the web. Behavioral targeting is now the white meat of marketing. The ability to attach behavior to specific identities is the quiet war taking place in media. There is still a long way to go. I am, as I write this, on a plane from Munich to Bangkok, where I spoke at the immensely enjoyable DLD conference. DLD is essentially a hip Davos, where followers of the religion of innovation pilgrimage to Munich to worship at the feet of our modern-day apostles. Kalanick, Hastings, Zuckerberg, Schmidt, etc. I can't obviously compete with those guys. So my strategy for getting more attendance and more YouTube views of my talk at DLD? I don a wig and, no joke, dance. I don't play fair, the basis of all good strategy. In sum, my business strategy message boils down to, what can you do really well that is also really hard? First, I say something in my talks. I highlight that Apple is the largest tax avoider in the world because lawmakers treat it like the hot girl on campus. If she pays a little attention to them, they swoon and are willing to enter into an abusive relationship. I say that Uber is fomenting an ethos in business that's terrible for society. 4,000 Uber employees and their investors will split $80 billion or more as the 1,600,000 drivers working for Uber will see their wages crash to a level that makes them the working poor. We used to admire firms that created hundreds of thousands of middle and upper class jobs. Now our heroes are firms that produce a dozen lords and hundreds of thousands of serfs. The CEOs at events like DLD can't respond to my claims because if they do, the markets might listen, and the consequences could be dramatic. In addition, they can actually get into serious legal trouble if they, accidentally, disclose non-public information. Thus, while I get to put on a show, their speeches are rehearsed and bleached of anything meaningful you haven't read before in a press release from their investor relations department. That's why people attend my talks. I'm free to tell the truth, or at least pursue the truth. I get it wrong all the time. The CEOs sit and listen to my talks and smile. It's the smile of poker players holding aces. And every one of those aces is data. In the last decade, the world's most important companies have become experts in data, its capture, its analytics, and its use. The power of big data and AI is that it signals the end of sampling and statistics. Now you can just track the shopping pattern of every customer in every one of your stores around the world, and then respond almost instantly with discounts, changes in inventory, store layouts, etc., and do so 24/7, 365. Or, better yet, you build in the technology to respond every second automatically. My favorite use of AI is Netflix autoplay for the next episode of a series, which has now been copied by other platforms. The result is a level of understanding about your customers, indeed about human nature itself, that has never before been possible. And against smaller, more regional companies, it offers a competitive advantage that is essentially unbeatable. The four have become wizards. Facility with data, and tech that updates the product real-time, will be a key component of the fifth horseman. No one has been able to aggregate more intention data on what consumers like than Google. Google not only sees you coming, but sees where you're going. When homicide investigators arrive at a crime scene and there is a suspect, almost always the spouse, they check the suspect's search history for suspicious Google queries, like how to poison your husband. I suspect we're going to find that U.S. agencies have been mining Google to understand the intentions of more than some shopper thinking about detergent, but cells looking for fertilizer to build bombs. Google controls a massive amount of behavioral data. However, the individual identities of users have to be anonymized and, to the best of our knowledge, grouped. People are not comfortable with their name and picture next to a list of all the things they have typed into the Google query box. And for good reasons. Take a moment to imagine your picture and your name above everything you have typed into that Google search box. You've no doubt typed in some crazy shit that you would rather other people not know. So Google has to aggregate this data, and can only say that people of this age or people of this cohort, on average, type in these sorts of things into their Google search box. Google still has a massive amount of data it can connect, if not to specific identities, to specific groups. And if you don't think they can't find you if they need to, remember, Google also used to claim it erased all of its records on a regular basis. How did that work out? Facebook can connect specific activities to a lot of specific identities. Facebook has 1 billion daily active users. People live their lives out loud on Facebook, documenting their actions, desires, friends, connections, fears, and purchase intentions. As a result, Facebook is tracking more specific identities than Google, a huge advantage when selling the ability to reach a specific audience. If I own a hotel in Hong Kong that caters to families, I can go to Facebook and ask for ads targeted to families of a certain income level that travel to Hong Kong at least twice a year. Facebook can identify and serve up the right consumers at a scale previously unimaginable because it can connect data to identity, and we're not as creeped out as we made this information publicly available ourselves. Amazon has 350 million credit cards and shopper profiles on file. More than any company on earth, it knows what you like. It's able to connect identity, shopping patterns, and behaviors. Not to be outdone, Apple has 1 billion credit cards on file and knows the media you most enjoy and, if Apple Pay works, even more than that. Apple, too, is able to attach purchase data to identity. Owning such a proprietary data set is the Chilean gold mines or the Saudi oil reserves of the information age. Just as important, these firms have the skills to leverage software and AI to uncover patterns and improve their offerings. Amazon does an immense number of A/B test emails to see what works best, while Google knows before anybody else what you are intending to do. Facebook likely will know more about the arc, texture, and intersection of actions and relationships than any entity in history. What is the end game? The payoff of this? The greatest aggregation of human talent and data assembled in history? To sell more Keurig Fortissimo Lungopods. 7. Accelerant. The seventh factor in the T algorithm is a company's ability to attract top talent. This requires being perceived by likely job candidates as a career accelerant. The war for tech-enabled talent has reached a fever pitch. A horseman's ability to attract and retain the best employees is the number one issue for all four firms. Their ability to manage their reputations, not only among young consumers, but also among their potential workforce, is critical to success. Indeed, one could argue that their brand equity among current and potential employees is more important than their consumer equity. Why? The team with the best players attracts cheap capital, innovates, and can spark the upward spiral that pulls away from the competition. If you're the valedictorian of your class, you have a jetpack strapped to your back in the form of intellect, grit, and emotional intelligence. But you are directionless. You are like Iron Man before he learned how to fly, all over the place. A lot of momentum, a lot of thrust, but not much progress. You need to find the right platform to point you in the right direction and accelerate your career. The Four Horsemen have reputations for doing just that. There are few places a talented 25-year-old can go further by age 30 in terms of role, money, prestige, and opportunities than at one of the four. The competition to work at one of these companies is brutal. At the nation's military service academies, during one of the first evening meals, it's a common practice to ask the cadets to stand if they accomplished something major in their childhood. Valedictorian, varsity athlete, Eagle Scout, National Merit Scholar. And as the cadets stand and look around, they are astonished to discover that everyone has accomplished those things. The same is true for the Four Horsemen. Formidable accomplishments are the baseline for applicants. Google is notorious for its vetting process for job applicants, including bizarre questions that have no real answers. The process is the message. If you survive, you are among the elite, the most brilliant members of your generation. There is no evidence that this process actually works, but that doesn't matter. Getting a job at one of the Four Horsemen is a ticket to the Tech Illuminati, and the trajectory of your career is about to go vertical. 8. Geography. Geography matters. There are few, if any, firms that have added tens of billions of dollars in the last decade that aren't a bike ride from a world-class technical or engineering teaching university. RIM and Nokia were the pride of their countries, and near the best engineering schools in those countries. The ability to develop and lubricate a pipeline with the best engineering talent from one of the best schools in the world is the eighth factor in the T algorithm. Three of the Four Horsemen, Apple, Facebook, and Google, have outstanding relationships with, and are a bike ride away from, a world-class engineering university, Stanford, and short drive to another, UC Berkeley, ranked number 2 and number 3 respectively. Many would argue the University of Washington, Amazon, is in the same weight class, number 23. To be an accelerant, you must have the raw material. Just as you used to build the electricity plant near the coal mine, the raw material today is top engineering, business, and liberal arts graduates. Tech software is eating the world. You need builders, people who can program software, and who have a sense for the intersection of tech and something that adds value to the enterprise and or the consumer. The best engineers and managers for that task come from, in greater proportions, the best universities. In addition, 2/3 of the world's GDP growth over the next 50 years will occur in cities. Cities will not only attract the best talent, but manufacture the best talent. The competition and opportunities are similar to rallying with Chris Everett. Your game just gets better. In many countries, like the UK and France, one city is responsible for 50% of the nation's GDP. 75% of large firms are located in what could be called a global supercity. Over the next 20 years, this tendency will likely increase, as firms now need to follow talented young people, not vice versa. Icons of yesteryear are opening urban campuses, prioritizing kids with beards, tattoos, and engineering degrees over people with kids. It's fairly easy to apply the T algorithm. I told Nike that to have a shot at a trillion, they would need to do three things. Increase percentage of direct-to-consumer retail to 40% within 10 years, closer to 10% in 2016. Gain greater facility with data and how to incorporate into product features. Move their headquarters from Portland. As I learned, the algorithm is the easy part. Getting them to listen to you, you need to relocate HQ from Portland, is the hard part. Chapter 9. The Fifth Horseman? Let's now apply our checklist of horseman traits to a number of emerging companies that have the potential to become the fifth tech giant. Where are these companies excelling, and where do they fall short? And what will it take to be the fifth horseman? This list of companies is not intended to be comprehensive. After all, great companies regularly appear seemingly out of nowhere, thanks to a technological advance, a shift in markets, or a change in demographics, but rather to be broad and thought-provoking. For all they have in common, the Four Horsemen occupy distinct roles in the digital age and have come to prominence through different paths. Two of them, Facebook and Google, dominate categories that did not exist 25 years ago. The other two, Amazon and Apple, are in well-established sectors. But while Amazon has overwhelmed its competition through brutally efficient operational prowess and access to cheap capital, Apple led product innovation and secured leadership at the high end, creating entirely new multi-billion dollar product categories and one of the world's great aspirational brands. Facebook had 1 billion users before its founder turned 32. while Apple took a generation to mature into the globally dominant company it is today. We should not presume then that the next company to emerge as a shaper of the digital age, a fifth horseman, will necessarily come from an obviously digital age industry, or be a highly touted unicorn with a college dropout at the helm. Nor can we presume the next horseman will arise in the United States, although it will certainly have to conquer the U.S. market on its road to success. We also can presume that the current four horsemen are all guaranteed to hold their positions for decades to come. After all, IBM ruled the electronics world through both the 1950s and 1960s, only to lose ground in hardware and, in an amazing feat of leadership, shift to a consulting company. Hewlett-Packard was the biggest tech company in the world just a decade ago, only to lose ground under weak leadership and then be broken up. Microsoft terrified the entire business world, especially tech, and seemed unstoppable in the 1990s. Like the others, it remains a giant company. But no one still thinks of it as an unstoppable juggernaut destined to rule the world. Still, the current four horsemen, as I've tried to explain in the previous chapters, have certain advantages in products, markets, stock valuation, recruiting, and management, who have assiduously studied why those earlier giants stumbled. That makes it unlikely they will lose their current dominance for a human generation or more. Famous last words. All have fought to get where they are, and they won't give up their leadership easily. Even when they collide against each other, they seem to make room before the competition gets too extreme. They, for now, seem, somewhat, content to coexist, rather than fight to the death. Now, let's look at the contenders. Alibaba. In April 2016, a native online commerce company surpassed Walmart to become the world's largest retailer. It was inevitable, but the surprise was that it was not Amazon that bested the Bentonville behemoth. It was Jack Ma's Chinese powerhouse Alibaba. To be fair, that's in part a function of Alibaba's business model, whereby it acts as a marketplace for other retailers, e-commerce and shopping, online auctions, money transfers, cloud data services, and a host of other businesses. And it is the $485 billion in gross merchandise value, GMV, of products sold through Alibaba that beats Walmart. Alibaba itself collects only a fraction of that in revenue, $15 billion in fiscal year 2016. But size matters. And nobody manages more retail trade than Alibaba. It makes up 63% of all China retail commerce, and 54% of packages that travel via Chinese post originate from an Alibaba business. Alibaba also boasts close to 500 million active users, 443 million, with more monthly active users, MAUs, accessing Alibaba via mobile phones, 493 million. Similar to the horsemen, the company has reshaped the retail landscape in China, turning an obscure tradition known as Singles Day, November 11th or 11/11, into the world's largest shopping day. The company did $17.4 billion in GMV on Singles Day alone in 2016, of which 82% originated from mobile. Alibaba has succeeded because it hit most of the markers we've outlined. It began in a vast market, China, filled with millions of small manufacturers desperate to reach the outside world. It went global almost immediately, reaching almost every country on the planet. It is a master of big data and AI, one of its services. And the market has given it a stratospheric valuation, so it has investment capital to burn. Alibaba has grown so fast that it essentially has no competition in its corner of the world. As with Amazon, it's easier just to work with Alibaba than to fight it. Many Western brands in China have shuttered their direct-to-consumer sites, unthinkable in the United States and Europe, to focus on their presence on Alibaba and sister property Tmall. Investors have taken note. In 2014, the company offered what remains the largest IPO in U.S. history, raising $25 billion on a valuation of $200 billion. The stock has underperformed the market since then. However, as I write this in early 2017, Baba has declined 15% in value from its offering, while Amazon has increased more than 100% over the same period. For all its vast scale, Alibaba faces significant challenges if it wishes to emerge as a global digital age player in the same class as the Four Horsemen. By definition, it has to expand in a more substantial way beyond its home market. And most important, it has to establish a material commercial presence in the United States, where it operates almost exclusively as an investor. The Chinese market, which seems to grow more volatile by the year, remains as much as 80% of Alibaba's business. As such, Alibaba carries a lot of water on its path to global domination. First, there is no historical precedent for a consumer brand emerging from China. The world is used to global brands from the United States and Europe, and more recently from Japan and South Korea, but not from China. Chinese firms face associations, legitimate or not, of labor exploitation, counterfeit goods, patent infringement, and governmental interference. Those characteristics are inconsistent with the Western values that underpin aspirational brands. And it hasn't helped that Alibaba's early reputation was tainted by claims that many of its small retailers were disreputable. Ultimately, Alibaba may benefit from the success Apple has had with overcoming concerns about Chinese manufacturing quality, and from other Chinese firms such as WeChat developing global followings. Yet the ultimate brand power, an aspirational brand that connotes leadership, luxury quality, and sex appeal, remains a reach for Alibaba. In 2016's list of the 100 most valuable brands, Forbes did not include Alibaba. Alibaba comes up short on visionary capital and has struggled to master storytelling, not just with consumers, but with investors, as Alibaba's opaque governance clouds the story. By comparison, the Four Horsemen are all acknowledged masters at telling their stories, selling their vision, and convincing shareholders to join their great crusades. Alibaba, as a conglomerate, doesn't have a real story to tell other than one of continuous success. As we've learned, that's not enough. Finally, a critical limitation to Alibaba's long-term success is the company's entanglements with the Chinese government. The government has supported its investment in a variety of ways, perhaps most substantially by severely curtailing the operations of Alibaba's U.S. competitors in China. Western investors are willing to accept some level of government interference, but they don't like what seems to be cheating, and the market distortions that result. While this relationship has doubtlessly been an asset for Alibaba during its growth, investors must be concerned about whose interests will win out when those of global shareholders do not align with the company's superpower patron. Indeed, because of Chinese restrictions on foreign ownership in Chinese assets, foreign investors do not actually own shares in Alibaba, but in a shell company with a contractual right to Alibaba profits. Contractual rights enforceable only in Chinese courts. And worse, there are signs that Alibaba cannot count on the support of the Chinese government, with critical stories about the company appearing in Chinese media and from government agencies since 2015. As for the accelerant factor, no doubt working for Alibaba carries considerable value in China and in other parts of the developing world. But in the West, not so much. Indeed, it may even prove a stigma, which means that as it moves into the Western markets, Alibaba may find recruiting great talent difficult, and its intellectual capital substandard. Alibaba's relationship with the Chinese government carries with it the risk that any number of foreign actors, including U.S. and European governments, might see Alibaba through a geopolitical lens and register their concern in the form of regulatory hurdles, investigations, and other roadblocks. These need not be political to be problematic. Jack Ma recently acknowledged that the SEC was investigating Alibaba for various reporting matters related to the firm's complex multi-company structure. Ma said that Alibaba's business model does not have any references in the U.S., so it's not just a matter of 1 or 2 days for the U.S. to understand Alibaba's business model. That's not exactly heartening. Finally, data privacy concerns are likely to be a constant thorn for Alibaba as it goes global, limiting its ability to leverage another T algorithm element, AI. In sum, the parent brand China provides an unwelcome halo of, we may not be cool, but we are corrupt. In high school, the bad boy who was also lame did not get laid. Tesla. History is littered with the skeletons of entrepreneurs who challenged Big Auto. They make movies about them. Think Tucker. But right now, it looks as if the movie about Elon Musk involves a dope outfit and a brooding Gwyneth Paltrow. Tesla faces challenges, but it has accomplished more than any other startup automobile company in our lifetime, and looks well-positioned to solidify its position as the market leader in electric-powered cars. Although it remains mostly a luxury product for Silicon Valley bros, its combination of design, no more Hobbit electric cars, innovation,